I'm ready.
Yeah, I'm actually asking Al if he's got the tape recorder on. Okay. It is September 22nd, 2010. We are interviewing Mr. Herb Sandler. Mr. Sandler, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today. My name is Chris Seifer. With me is Al Crago. We are with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009 that instructs us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis and deliver a report by the end of this year, actually December 15th. That statute tells us to look at many different things, including institutions that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of exceptional government assistance. And I think about 22 separate different areas within Section 1 of the statute, including non-traditional mortgage loans, securitization, mortgage fraud, etc. So we obviously thought it would be good to talk to you, given your long time in the thrift and banking industry in general. And I will tell you that one of the institutions we looked at earlier in the year was Wachovia Corporation. So and we are also looking at Countrywide Corporation. So one, Wachovia, of course, bought your company in 2006. And Countrywide and Golden West and subsequently Wachovia were very much involved in the payment option ARM product, which unfortunately has not performed that great and has caused some problems for several institutions.
So Matt, do you want me to interrupt and correct any of what you're saying now, or shall I wait till the Q&A?
Fair enough. You know what? I'm finished. So interrupt me now and correct me, and then summarize your educational and work background, and then we'll get to more substance.
Well, I wanted to do the background. So I graduated from City College of New York in, Jesus Christ, I don't remember the year. And then I went to Columbia Law School, practiced law for several years. Then my wife and I and our families acquired what was then Golden West Savings, which subsequently changed to World Savings, a subsidiary of Golden West Financial Corporation, which we operated from 1963 until 2006 when it was sold to Wachovia. Subsequent to that time, I'm full-time working in the foundation, mm-hmm. the Sandler Foundation. Now, that's the education and history. I don't know if you want anything else on the work record, but... to answer, to make the comment I wanted to make, I'd have to give you some history.
Please.
And is it okay to talk?
Of course.
Okay. I don't want to bore you. First of all, the so-called option arm has produced more disinformation, more inaccurate statements, more nonsense than almost on virtually any other topic that I know of, and I hear a lot of nonsense on a lot of topics. We talked about your history in the financial regulation business. The problems that took place in the early 80s and lasted throughout that period, and which cost the U.S. taxpayers about $150 billion before interest, when that used to be considered real money, was essentially caused, as you probably know, by the so-called borrowing short and lending long, the only instrument that most thrift institutions in this country could make, and we were the primary provider of money for residential lending, was a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. The regulators knew better that it should be changed and adjustable rates authorized, but pressure from Congress and certain congressmen on the banking committee, one of whom was Senator Proxmire in particular, made it clear that no regulator should give that authority. When it was all right to have 30-year fixed-rate loans in the environment that followed World War II, when for an extended period of time, rates were relatively stable, and there were no extremes or significant spike in interest rates, and therefore you could survive despite the fact the institution was obviously taking significant interest rate risk. And incidentally, what I'm saying to you, much of it is on the website in dealing with the history of the ARM, and it's also mentioned in one of the attachments, which is the Great Western white paper on the adjustable rate loan, subsequently called the option arm. So in any event, let me just get back to my train of thought. Where was I?
30-year fixed rate loans, fine, as long as you got stable interest rates.
So what happened is, finally, after the disaster took place, which resulted in the disappearance of about 2,500 thrift institutions through the borrowing short, lending long, and the cost to the taxpayers had been incurred, a new chairman of the Federal Home Loan Bank, by the name of Dick Pratt, in May of 1981, finally authorized federal institutions to make an adjustable rate loan. There were numerous types of adjustable rate loan structures that were available, but they really, at the end of the day, after you analyze them all, they fell into two broad categories. One was the so-called non-negatively amortizing adjustable rate mortgage, in which the index, the interest rate on the loan would move with an index up, but there would be no ability to defer any of the payments. Mm-hmm. The other, which originated in Great Britain, which had a history for a long time of making adjustable rate mortgages, had a the so-called negatively amortizing loan, one loan that permitted deferred interest.
Right.
But when one analyzed the non-negatively amortizing loan, which was used primarily, incidentally, and adopted primarily by smaller institutions on the East Coast, and the reason I say emphasize smaller, most of these institutions had no financial analytic capability and did not understand the risk that they were undertaking and the borrowers were going to be put under through that loan, because that loan would permit significant increases in interest rate to the borrower, which meant that the borrower would have payment shock, almost virtually guaranteed in any even modestly increasing interest rate environment. And those of us who did have financial capability saw that risk. And that's what attracted us to what later became be known as the option arm. And that is a loan that permitted, that constrained the payment from being increased more than 7.5% once a year. And that if there was any excess payment due, which would have fully amortized the loan, the borrower, instead of making the higher payment above and beyond 7.5%, could defer the interest and add it to the loan. Not unlike, incidentally, the way equity lines of credit work, which is a way of doing exactly the same thing, which most people don't seem to understand.
Mm-hmm.
That loan was intended by the chairman of the Federal Home Loan Bank to be used by the institutions under his jurisdiction, which were largely, almost entirely, portfolio lenders. That is, institutions that originated loans, did not sell them, and held them in their books. Because that was exactly the problem. The problem is that previously you had been holding 30-year loans, and the cost of liabilities in the early 80s were in excess of what we were receiving on the fixed-rate loan.
Mm-hmm.
You can interrupt with questions at any time.
Okay.
What is very disturbing is this is a loan which is an extraordinarily good loan for borrowers, a borrower-friendly loan which permits them to deal with these issues in a way which has little risk. Now, the institutions that really started this loan, the other thing that's inaccurate is we're described as the originator of the loan. A, had been used in Great Britain and Scotland for many years. B, the primary originators of it in this country were institutions that were much larger than us, and they were Home Savings, which was the largest, and you'll know these names,
right,
and Great Western and American, and some of the large San Diego institutions. We were much smaller than they, and we were a player. We adopted the loan. But, quote, we did not create the loan or originate the loan. They did much more volume than we did in those days. I think the reason we're mentioned as the originator is none of those institutions machines are around anymore.
Right.
So that alone, again, so the thing, another thing that's quite annoying when you think about it is that people are talking about this loan as a loan which creates payment shock. The structure of this loan is designed exactly for the purpose of avoiding payment shock, which is absolutely endemic in the negatively amortizing adjustable rate mortgage. Now I'm going to kind of bring it up to date and get closer to the point you made. So the portfolio lenders, lenders which intended to keep it on their books, started making that loan in 1981, and through the period, in our case, when we sold it, and in the case of the other institutions, until they merged or whatever happened to them, there were very, very low loss rates. Now, I didn't neglect to point out one thing, that in looking at the various arms, and in particular the so-called payment option arm, at least our company, and I know this is true to the same extent or more so because of their greater size, we in our company ran thousands of simulations tracking back over 40 or 50 years exactly every interest rate that took place to determine what would have happened had somebody taken this loan compared to what would have happened if they'd taken a fixed rate loan. In addition, we ran all kinds of simulations concerning the loan, what would happen if interest rates went up so much? What happened if they went down, they went up, they went up, they went down, they went sideways? Every single thing we could think of. We would then make assumptions about home prices. What if home prices continued to go up at 2 or 4%? What happened if home prices stayed flat? What happens if home prices went down 5%? What happened if home prices went down 10%? And then you couple that with all of the different interest rate alternatives that one could literally figure out. And what it showed is that unless there was something extraordinary, which had never happened before, that all the deferred interest would go up and deferred interest would go down, and that over any kind of reasonable cycle, that the borrower would be in exactly the same position, but because the lending institution could avoid the interest rate risk, they would charge less, and the borrower would in fact end up paying less for a loan with no risk. And as a matter of fact, for our company, that proved to be exactly the case during that 25-year period. Not 1-year period, not 2-year period, not 5-year period, but for a quarter of a century, it worked exactly as the simulations showed that it would. And we have never been able to identify a single loan that was delinquent because of the structure of a loan, much less a loss or foreclosure. Now, what happened? What happened was that in the early 2000s, the mortgage bankers, notably Countrywide, IndyMac, WaMu, realized, let me go back, they had never made these kinds of loans. They had no interest in these loans because they only played a very small part in the market. The adjustables were a tiny part of the real estate lending market. We were kind of a niche player, those of us who were doing this thing, as mortgage bankers took a larger and larger share of market during that 20-year period. I know I'm talking pretty fast, but I hope it's all right with you.
It is. You're doing fine.
I'm on a riff. I'm on a roll. So what happened was that during the period from the early 80s, as a result of the weakening of the thrift industry, mortgage bankers started to take a larger and larger share of market. So those of us who were portfolio lenders occupied a very small part of the entire residential lending market, which of course was not of great interest to the mortgage bankers. But in 2001 or 2002, Countrywide in particular, as well as the others that I've mentioned, plus others I haven't mentioned, realized that by changing the structure of the loan that the portfolio lenders had been originating, they could probably originate sizable volume at sizable profits. And so they changed the structure in four different ways, at least, maybe five or more. One, instead of a 10-year period of time before a recast was required, they changed to 5 years. Instead of 125% of the original balance for mandatory recast, they changed it to 110%. Then what they did is they used a very low start rate, much I call the difference between a fully indexed rate and the start rate a discount. And they created discounts that we would never have made as portfolio lenders because the risk would have been too great. So Countrywide took their start rate down to 1%. I think the rest of us at the time was something like 3 or 3.5. And then what they did is, actually at the time they did it was not that crazy because interest rates were quite low. But what happened is when the Fed started to raise interest rates, the discount became larger and larger. It became as large as 5 or 6%, which was sheer insanity if you had run the simulations or knew anything about the history of the loan. In addition, the loan-to-values of portfolio lenders were typically under 80. In our case, they were 71%. Countrywide, WAMU, and IndyMac were making 100% loans. The underwriting, they didn't really do underwriting. What they did is they took automated underwriting with a FICO score, and their appraisals were either automatic AVMs, automatic valuation models, or they used fee appraisers, which meant it was a bunch of garbage anyway. So what they did is they took a loan that was borrower-friendly, and they made it into a toxic loan, which we warned regulators about again and again and again. I mean, one of the worst things they did on underwriting is that in our company, we always underwrote the loan that the borrower had to qualify at the fully indexed rate, at least at the fully indexed rate. And these folks were originating loans based on, in some cases, as low as the start rate. So if the fully indexed loan was a 6% rate, and we would require somebody to qualify with that kind of an interest rate, and they were at 1%, they would qualify some of their borrowers at 1%, 2%, 3%. And why? Because we as a portfolio lender were dependent, our business model was totally dependent upon high quality of the loans, very low loan losses. In their case, they were passing on, or they thought they were passing on the risk to others, and therefore had no liability at all. And I'm going to digress for a minute because I can't help myself. In the securitization process, there were four players. None of those players had any skin in the game, and therefore none of them gave a goddamn, and that's one of the big reasons for some of these problems. It started with the mortgage broker who just collected his fees. It went on to the rating agencies who didn't give a damn, and you've seen all the stories on that, you know what they did.
Right.
They had no skin in the game. It went to the mortgage banker who was selling it, and they had no skin in the game, and that's the Countrywides of the world. And then the fourth player was the investment banker, who were putting together garbage that they never should have touched with a 10-foot pole, and they had no skin in the game. And in connection with the mortgage bankers, I don't know if you're familiar with ProPublica, which is an investigative newsroom, but has written a series of superb, brilliant articles on the CDO market and how that was totally gamed by people who were ripping everybody off. I recommend it to you if you haven't seen it.
We have seen them, and we've read them.
Yes, one of them was on Magnetar,
right?
And then, which was sensational. And then the follow-up was on the Merrill Lynch's, in which these brokers were the registered reps, you know, the sales people at the investment banking firms were creating garbage. They were buying each other CDOs. There's actually a follow-up story, I think, in today's ProPublica on it.
Right.
So okay, I'll stop. Stop for breath.
So let me ask you a couple follow-ups just to make sure
I want to make one final point.
Of course, go ahead.
With a hammer and not knock the nail in.
Right.
So I am infuriated by the fact that our option arm discusses an option arm the same as Countrywide. They are two extraordinarily different loans. As a matter of fact, I think the option arm, as we and other portfolio lenders originated it, and the option arm is originated by Countrywide, IndyMac, WaMu, etc., are more different than the difference between an adjustable rate loan and a fixed rate loan. Mm-hmm. They are two different loans, but unfortunately, media and other alleged pundits don't do their homework and don't understand the difference.
Right, so let me ask you a couple things to make sure that I'm understanding you correctly. Now, when you were talking about the payment option arm loans that World Savings was originating for its portfolio, and you were talking about the 7.5% max interest rate, that was the maximum pay rate on the
payment,
loan, right?
The payment rate. In other words, if the payment was during the year in which you took out the loan was $1,000, and let's assume interest rates had bumped up considerably during that period of time, and your new rate should be $1,200, $1,200.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it couldn't go up to more than $1,075, and the excess could be added to principal if so desired by the borrower.
Right, and then in terms of underwriting and qualifying the borrower for that loan, would they be qualified at the maximum 7.5% rate?
No, they didn't. No, that's not what you're looking at. When you talk about the fully indexed rate, what you're saying is, let's assume that whatever the index was X, so let's say the index was 4, and let's pretend that the spread at that time was 250.
Okay.
That would be a 6.5% loan. That's what the borrower would be paying if it was fully indexed.
Right.
And let's pretend your start rate was 4. Which incidentally is a reasonable start rate in those circumstances.
Right.
So we would have qualified that borrower only if they could satisfy the payment at 6.5%. Other institutions, these new guys, would have qualified them at 4%. What made it horrible is, in order to get volume, because their business model was driven not by quality, because they frankly didn't give a damn, but it was driven by volume. That's how they made their money, only with great volume. And so they took it down to 1. So let's assume it was 6.5% and their starting rate was 1%. Some of them would qualify the borrower at 1%, which means they're totally unqualified to pay the loan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's an extraordinary difference, what I'm describing.
Right, and I remember folks being
Add
qualified
that
at teasers.
To the fact, compound that by saying that in addition to that, you have an LTV of 90 to 100%. What will happen is the loan now, using the structure they use, if you run simulations, what you will see is that loan is guaranteed in a 2 to 3 year period to require a recast of enormous proportions. In our case, because of the way we did it, we have, during the period I was at the company, I don't know if we ever had a recast in excess of 7.5% ever, out of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of loans, the millions of loans.
Mm-hmm.
And you read in the press the discussion all the time about this recast problem. And if you looked at Wells Fargo's earnings conferences, the same thing that was true with us is true with Wells Fargo. They're continuing to have virtually no recasts whatsoever. So have you been looking at the site, did you see the chart that compared the different arm structures?
Yes, sir.
Because that lays it out.
Yes, sir. I think it does a good comparing and contrasting World's underwriting or standard along the 5 points that you mentioned, the start rate, the LTV.
Right. The other thing, yes, which we haven't talked about because I don't think it's relevant to you at the moment, is the 228s and the 327s, which are they're really the same loan. Those were inherently toxic and totally predictable that they would force a borrower into foreclosure. That was the predominant loan in the subprime market.
Mm-hmm.
The New Century, AmeriQuest, they were the ones who used that. And that loan was devised for the purpose of stripping equity from poor to moderately income, low and moderate income folks, and it succeeded. There's an enormous amount of work done on that in a number of the studies and papers published by the Center for Responsible Lending, which has all kinds of data on the 228-327s.
Right. They actually were at our first hearing.
But they have an incredible amount of stuff they would done. They did it in conjunction largely with the University of North Carolina.
Yeah, Mr. Sandler, I remember seeing that on your website that the option arms have been erroneously linked up with the 228s and the 327s. And
right. That was the New York Times article.
Yes.
And New York Times, the reporter absolutely did not understand the difference between a 228, which is a subprime type loan, the countrywide version of the option arm, and the portfolio version of the option arm. They never got it and tarnished our name because of that, even though we rubbed their noses in it ultimately.
So let me ask you, you mentioned in the 2001...
Oh, one last thing, sorry,
sure.
I'm going to make sure I get all my points.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned in your earlier statements about the losses. Well, you know, there was enormous estimates about the losses. If you look at the Wells data, and I can't get it exactly because I don't have the background of it anymore. I don't have access to that stuff.
Did you say Wells, sir, or Wachovia?
Oh, Wells acquired Wachovia.
I'm sorry.
So, it's okay?
No, yes.
Are you with me?
I understand.
So what I'm saying is Wells, subsequent to the time they acquired Wachovia, put out their earnings releases, and a lot of their time has been in disclosing the stuff on the option arm or pick or pay, whatever you want to call it. And all these estimates of these enormous losses, well, it's now 4 years subsequent to the merger, and the estimate of total losses from the Wachovia portfolio to date, in an environment in which unemployment is much higher than when they did the projections, and the meltdown is much worse than when they did the projections, looks like it's in the total in the $12 or $13 billion area, of which approximately only half are Golden West Savings loans. So you saw all these numbers of great losses, and you alluded to it in your earlier statement, and they ain't happened.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say, let me actually ask you about that. When you say that about 50% or half of the $12 to $13 billion of losses that Wells is disclosing in its earnings releases are World Savings loans, does that mean that the other half were originated subsequent to the acquisition?
That's right. In other words, looking at the data, and I'm guessing it's a 50%. It might be 40%. It might be 60%. Mm-hmm. But the best estimate is 50%. 50% of the losses were made by Wachovia subsequent to October of 2006, and 50% were in the Golden West portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you should know that in areas that we lent in, which and I'm not proud of all of this, were like in we had office in Antioch, we had offices in Modesto and Stockton. We felt we had an obligation to lend there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those areas have shown home price reductions of between 50 and 75%. Now, I don't care who you are as a lender. You can be the best lender in the history of the world. You're going to have some losses in those areas.
Right. Yeah, I'm actually from San Francisco still. I'm just out here for the year, and I actually live in Walnut Creek in addition to San Francisco, so I'm very familiar with what's been going on with home prices.
Yeah, but Walnut Creek is pretty good.
No, right. Yeah, I'm fine.
but if you lived in Modesto, we actually have seen home price declines. I've actually seen them in excess of 75%, but large numbers in those areas and in the Inland Empire of 50 to 75%. You just do the numbers, you realize you're going to have losses. So the question isn't how big the losses are. The question is, my God, how come the losses are so low?
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you know this, although maybe it's, in fact, maybe this comes off your website or otherwise, but after you sold Golden West to Wachovia, do you know if they changed their underwriting standards? Do you know if they loosened them up for the types of loans?
I don't know. There are people in the world who would know. I don't know, and I don't want to cast any stones. The only thing I do know is that I understand they did one thing that we never did in our entire history, and that is that they set loan volume goals. At our company, we never set goals. What we did is we asked the loan department how they felt about the environment, how they felt about the interest rate scenario, and what were they comfortable in doing loans which would maintain the quality of our portfolio. And I think if you looked at the site, you know, we have the lowest losses over that 40-year period, including the 25 years of the so-called option on period, lower than any other lender in the country of size. And during the last 8 years, we had zero losses. So, you know, spare me from the garbage I'm listening to.
Okay. So let me ask you this. You mentioned that in, you know, the game sort of changes a bit in 2001 and 2002 when the mortgage bankers of the world start originating this loan product, although given the
big... It's the same name. You know, incidentally, you know where Option Arm came from? We never called it an Option Arm. WAMU had a marketing thing when they were getting very aggressive. They called it Option Arm, and because they were the largest in the industry at that time, that became the name of a loan. We didn't name it the Option Arm. Mm-hmm. The point is, we had a particular loan structure and a particular kind of underwriting and a particular kind of appraisal and a particular kind of loan-to-value. And what they did is, because, in my opinion, two things. Number one, they thought they had no risk. And also, frankly, because they knew nothing of the history of the loan. So remember, in 1981, those of us who had not been permitted to make loans suddenly have the authority, and we're spending all of our time researching every single kind of adjustable rate loan made any place in the world to see what fit best. And we understood it. We ran thousands of simulations, all of us did. And this became clearly the right loan. And these guys didn't know anything about it, and they changed it. But because it looks, if you don't look at the detail, from a 3,000 feet high in the air, it looks like it's the same kind of loan. Gee, you can defer interest, you have payments, you have options on what payment to make. They all thought it was the same loan. Two entirely different kinds of loans.
Mr. Sandler, can I ask you a quick question regarding, you mentioned WAMU, and yes, it's in the public domain that in 2004, the Option Arm was their signature product. And what I'm about to read to you is a public document that was made public in the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations in the U.S. Senate. It's a WAMU document, and it's comparing and contrasting WAMU underwriting versus World. And it's called, the slide, I could read you the number of the reference so that you can go back and read it if you wanted to, but it said Golden West Underwriting Approach and Wachovia Fit. That's the subheading.
And then say that again.
Golden West Underwriting Approach and Wachovia Fit.
And Wachovia, year is this done?
This is in the 2006.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So what it's saying, and I'll quote from it, it says, more relaxed underwriting documentation standards. And then it says, World has traditionally required less verification of assets and income from its customers. Reportedly, this has started to change in the last several years, but it is still more lenient than WAMU. Now, I'm just reading this, and I wanted to get your reaction, whether or not you agree with that. And also, if you could speak to the type of underwriting documentation that you would require for assets and for income, et cetera.
Okay, well, what you're really talking about is something like the so-called stated income. So I'm going to give you the history of it, okay?
Okay.
I mean, there are very few people who still know any of this information. There was a company in the old days by the name of Greenpoint, run by a guy named Jerry Lasorda in Brooklyn, New York, which actually had among the lowest losses of any financial institution. I'm going way back now. And we were trying to figure out what they were doing. because it just seemed that their losses were so incredibly low. We thought we were low, and they were as low or lower than we were, which we found impossible to believe. And so we spent a lot of time there and got to know them well. And one of the techniques they used on the underwriting, remember there's two parts about, there's more than two parts, there's a lot of parts about making a loan, underwriting, appraisals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I'll deal only with the underwriting. The appraisals are a separate story, which is also interesting. So what they would do is they would get documents based on the necessity for documents. So let me give you a hypothetical. And became a terrific marketing ploy when used right. So what you would do is, Al, you would come in for a loan, and I'm going to assume you're a really good credit, okay? And you'd be buying, you'd say you're working for, I'll make you a teacher. Is that all right?
That's fine, sir.
You're a teacher, and you come in and you're looking for a loan at X. And what I would do, we'd get your credit report. But what we would do is we would not demand your tax records at the beginning or all of that stuff. But what we would do, though, is validate your employment. We find out, you said you're a teacher in Walnut Creek. Now, of course, we have enormous amount of data, and we know what teachers get paid in Walnut Creek, and I'm making the numbers up right now, and I'm going to assume it's $45,000, and you're buying a house, which is the appropriate size house for somebody making $45,000, although Walnut Creek is a bad place I selected.
Right.
But let's do that for the sake of discussion. We would not collect a lot of data which somebody else would collect for that, because A, we know you're working there, you've been working there for 6 years, 8 years, we know what they get paid. I don't have to believe you or not believe you. I know if you're teaching there, that's what you're making. And if everything else, and if I'm making a 65 or 70% loan to value, I'm not going to get all the documentation. Now you come in again and you tell me you're a teacher there, and instead of buying a home in the, let's say, I'm making all these numbers up, in the $180,000 or $200,000, you come in and you're buying a house of $600,000.
Right.
Or you tell me in your application that you're a teacher there in Walnut Creek, but and your income is $300,000. Bells and whistles go off, and then more documentation is required. And if that doesn't satisfy our underwriters, more documentation is required. So you might come in and you may be entitled to, based on our experience and our knowledge and our processes, that you really don't have to be fully documented. You won't be. And if you do have to be fully documented, you will be. I'm laughing about WAMA, which I'll talk about in a moment. If you said, we don't have all of the documentation that somebody else might have, that might be true. One of the things that makes me laugh is mortgage bankers used to get full documentation and very fancy, typed-up data, but the loans were garbage.
Right.
So WAMU, as did Countrywide, as did IndyMac, really only got one thing. They got a FICO score. Are you aware about how crappy the FICO scores are?
Yes, sir.
Are you aware that there are, there are three big credit agencies? Are you aware that you could have a difference of 100 points between those three agencies?
Yes.
That you could pick the one that you wanted to pick?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're telling me that a company that's a total disaster, I'm very competitive with us, and knowing that we're the class of the industry, is going to say something pejorative. I mean, I have to laugh.
Well,
what did they do on their appraisers? They used AVMs, the models, or they used fee appraisers. Do you know how a fee appraiser works?
Made
when you work there, you must. When you were at the when you were in that section, you must have found out about that. If it's a purchase for $300,000, what do you think the fee appraiser is going to come in with?
At least three.
And the reason is, there's a reason, it's really a serious issue, and and I don't know how they're going to solve it. That has a real moral problem. I know it's not worth three. I know that this loan is 270. This property is 270. If I come in with 270, I will never get a call again, because that call came to you from the loan representative whose commission or bonus depends on making that loan. So you know you must come in with that number. If you do your research, you'll find out, A, we had our own appraisal staff who were evaluated on the quality of the appraisals, and two, that we were known as a low appraisal company. This is actually in the marketplace, and it hurt us in terms with certain offices in terms of getting applications. So it's a whole package. But the thing on the so-called state—oh, I should finish on the stated income. There's a funny story. Great Western, which, as you may remember, was the second largest, just a little bit smaller than Home, used a similar technique in their underwriting as we did, as I just described it. There was a company in New York, and I'm really speaking to, what's your first name?
Chris.
In New York, you may remember Dime Savings Bank.
Oh, yes, yes.
And it was headed by Harry Albright, who incidentally had been previously the head of the banking, superintendent of banks in New York. And Harry was a terrific guy, but he tremendously admired Great Western, again, because of its size and its success. But he never understood how their program worked. So what he did, he just didn't get any information at all for anybody. Whereas Great Western would get a little bit of information for a loan that's 100% safe based on experience. And as it got less and less safe, they required more and more documentation. Harry didn't get any documentation for anybody. And of course, Harry went under. Dime Savings, as you may remember, went under.
Yes.
So I don't know if that's helpful to you or responsive.
It is. I mean, it's essentially the same story. I mean, you underwrite the loan and determine whether or not it's a good loan, and the other stuff, frankly, is extraneous.
And you get the material that's relevant to make the decision.
So here's the next thing I want to ask you. You had mentioned before that in 2001 and 2002, the mortgage bankers like WaMu, Countrywide, and IndyMac come onto the scene and start originating this product, one, loosening underwriting standards quite a bit.
Underwriting to the wrong interest rate. But I think the thing that was really pernicious was that low start rate.
Right. And then, two, of course, as you mentioned, them and other folks in the chain didn't have any skin in the game. This is an originate-to-distribute model as opposed to originate-to-portfolio model. And you had mentioned before that when these types of products started being originated, that you were complaining and warning folks.
Well, actually, you see this letter. I don't know, Al, whether you saw it in the file, but did you see any of the letters we wrote talking about those issues?
Yeah, particularly the response that you had to the NTM guidance on or around March of 06. That was...
I reread. Good. I'm sorry. Finish.
Yeah. So in the 01-02 time frame, I mean, were you...
They didn't really... It really didn't start then. I think Countrywide started to get active in 2002, and then 2003 is when they really went back big time.
Right, and of course 03 was the low interest rate year when we had a huge amount of refinancings.
And in that
year and subsequently, what I'm interested in hearing from you is who you were talking to in terms of regulators, and saying, hey, look at what's going on here, and then two, what their responses were, because at least as far as I can tell now in 2010, looking back, it certainly didn't, they didn't stop it.
Well, I'm not sure whether they didn't stop entirely. I spoke to folks both in Washington, I can't recall as much, but the ones in San Francisco. So I spoke to a series of people on an ongoing basis. Let's see if I can remember his name. Boy, this is Richard.
Richard Riccobono?
But toward the end, it was Nick Dyer.
I remember Nick.
Yeah. Nick's a good guy. Mm-hmm. But it's Richard Sanchez.
I remember Richard Sanchez.
Right. And what I would do is I would say, remember, the ones I would talk mostly about the ones that were under their jurisdiction, because Countrywide, actually, for a good part of that period, was an OCC.
Right, not until March of 07 did they become an OCS
right.
shop.
So that was after my time.
Right.
But I would talk about IndyMac, I would definitely talk about WAMU, and there were a bunch of others. And what I would explain to them is a little bit of what I was talking about here, is that the simulations show that what they're doing must end up in disaster. And I'm sure if you spoke to either one of them, they would tell you that I made calls. I felt I was doing the right thing as a public service, and I was also doing the right thing for OTS, is to clue them in on what was going on. And I believe every so often we saw, and this is the, you know, they never tell you, they listen, they never give you a reaction to what you're saying to them.
Right.
But they do listen, and I do remember that on a number of occasions I would get reports back from the field that such and such is now behaving somewhat better. Of course, it didn't last that long, but when I heard that, I would have the feeling that somebody must have spoken to them.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever hear from...
It wasn't as bad, and so it was quite... I have to tell you that, remember I mentioned 81, 82, when I spoke to Jack Pullen, and the Savings Loan Commissioner then was a guy named Larry Taggart, who was a total slime.
Yeah.
and the... because I was doing a lot of testifying back then, and the situation that really bothered me, Taggart, I think, was on the take. I don't know if he was or wasn't, but he was a bad person. I was told that... I couldn't understand why Pullen, I gave really good information, I can never understand why he didn't do anything. I was told later that the high flyers were telling Pullen that our company and a few others who were also complaining were doing it because we were unable to compete with these new operators. We weren't smart enough and fast enough on our feet. And what we saw was the emperor had no clothes. You know, for example, Charlie Knapp.
Right.
Remember him?
Oh, yes.
American?
Yeah.
You know, it was clear that he was a high flyer and was going to take the company down. And he and Bell Savings and a bunch of the other companies I can't recall now, we were told later on, were telling him that we were afraid of the competition, and that's the reason we were bad-mouthing them and saying all these terrible things. He never did anything, and I felt later like a schmuck.
Mm-hmm.
I think on the guys like Sanchez and Dyer, I thought they were more serious. They seemed interested. They wanted me to feed them the information, but I never could tell what exactly they did.
Mm-hmm. Did you talk to folks other than Dyer and Sanchez? I mean, like, I remember when I was back there, and those folks were, you know, then assistant directors.
Bill Black and I talked all the time.
Right.
And then I also talked to a successor who then came to work for us later on, Dirk Adams, and I talked to people in Washington, but you know the names are all hazy now.
Right, right. Okay. Let me ask you this more of a broad-based question that's similar to this. You know, one of the things the statute tells us to look at is the role of fraud in the financial crisis. And, you know, what are your opinions on that?
Tremendous given amount of fraud. We had to work extremely hard. It made things very, very difficult. The worst area was Southern California, L.A., which I used to call the fraud capital of the world. I would not be the right person to give you detail because I looked at it from a very high level, and just to ask questions about how do we check for fraud, what are our tests, what are the steps we take, et cetera, et cetera. But there are people, again, this is probably pretty late in your timetable, but there are people who could give you chapter and verse of what the patterns of fraud were. You know, the mortgage brokers are... You know, for example, let's talk about mortgage brokers. They really, I've been quoted on this already, so I can't get into any more trouble. I call them the whores of the world. I never could understand why they were needed and what services they really provided and why they got the fees that they got from the borrowers, etc. But what happened is, if you go back historically, at one point, the thrifts were two-thirds, 80% or more of all residential lending. The banks were a very small percentage, and they were in and out of the market. And then there was a small mortgage brokerage industry. And when the thrifts were wounded in the 80s from what we described before, that's when they started to get more and more powerful. And ultimately, somewhere between 60 and 70% of residential loans were made through them. And the reason for that, in part, is the real estate offices, where certainly most of the purchase loans originate. It's easier for them, frequently, to go to a mortgage broker because the mortgage broker will virtually guarantee them a loan from any one of several lenders, assuming they themselves don't have their own lending operation. So what happens when they bring it to a lender is they submit a package to the lender, and with their appraisal, and I put their appraisal in quotes,
right,
their underwriting in quotes, and a big package. And the Countrywides and IndyMax of the world take those packages, and it becomes their package. And if there's crap and garbage and falsehoods in the package, that's it. In our case, because of our point of view about mortgage brokers, we did something that was extremely costly for us, but we felt essential since we were a quality lender. We could not ignore the mortgage broker, because if two-thirds of all business is originated by them, that means that you're competing for business in this small niche. So we're already in a small niche, and it puts us in an even smaller niche. So what we would do is we would take the package from the mortgage broker, but we would treat it only as if it were an application. Mm-hmm. And we would do our own underwriting from start to finish, our own appraisals by our own in-house staff, totally disregarding their appraisal, totally disregarding their underwriting, but treating it as if they were a realtor just submitting an application to us.
Mm-hmm. And the reason you did that, sir, is because you were going to portfolio the loan and because your
systems
were different.
But also, there's another reason also. It's the right thing to do. Let's not forget the moral part of this. Morals still exist. Rarely.
Mm-hmm. When you would re-underwrite
the issue is, as being a portfolio lender, I'm at risk on the loan.
Right.
If it's a bad loan, I take the loss.
Right, and the mortgage banker already has his or her fee.
They're gone. They're gone. Actually, one of the most interesting things, and you would have seen since you read all the material, which I'm very impressed with, you'll remember a reference to the fact that, it just went out of my mind. It was something, it's not a big point. It was just a kind of a laugh line. I'll think of it while we're talking.
So let me ask you.
I get senior moments.
It's okay.
So do we.
Did you have a lot of instances where, in re-underwriting the loan from the mortgage brokers, that your appraiser, your in-house appraisal, and their appraisal?
Are you kidding?
Okay, so that was a frequent occurrence.
All the time.
Frequent occurrence.
Very frequent.
Like, would you say 50% of the time?
You have to talk to people who are on the line, the head of underwriting, people like that, or people who really work on day to day. But we discussed at great length over the years how untrustworthy the mortgage brokers were, and the material coming from them was. And it was, when a realtor comes to you, he gives you the loan app, or he will introduce you to the potential borrower, and you'll have him fill out a loan application. When we got something from the mortgage broker, all we were interested in is the application. We would do all the work ourselves as if it had been handed to us, as if he had walked in off the street.
When you had differences, did you reconcile those differences, or would you just part ways and that mortgage broker would take it to the
Reconcile with a lie?
No. Well, poor choice.
No, I'm serious. If we're appraising it at 250, and he's appraising it at 3.25, I'm making the extreme to make the
right,
point.
Right.
I mean, how do I reconcile?
Right. So he would just take his business to another banker, correct?
Well, if he was willing to take the 75% loan on 250, that's okay. It would have been a 60% loan or 50% loan on their appraisal.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. We lose loans.
Gotcha. And was that a frequent occurrence?
I'm certain it was. What's our decline ratio? Did you see it as something like 50 to 60%? It's interesting. It even got higher. It's in the material. Where we have a table which shows the percentage of declines.
Yes.
That's very high.
And you're talking about the percentage of declines for broker loans?
No, I don't have it broken out for broker, but you can certainly figure it out because you know what the percentage is coming in from the mortgage broker.
Right.
But we have a large number of declines.
Let me ask you a similar type question, a little different than fraud, but the whole predatory lending issue. I mean, again, you know, I don't know if the statute specifically says this, but, you know, there's a lot out there about how the unscrupulous, you know, lender, loan broker, whoever, are putting, you know, borrowers that may not be the most sophisticated or educated in the world into loans that, you know, they
That's a serious, serious, serious problem.
So tell us what you've seen.
And it's the job of the lending institution to avoid that to whatever extent you can. You're not going to be perfect. Things are going to slip through. And then suddenly, on those occasions when we were running the company, when we saw a situation like that, we would straighten it out. We would deal with it. Unlike our experience with the press, who will not admit error directly and apologize, when we made a mistake, we would say, mea culpa, we've made a mistake. How do we put you back in the position you should be in? If you look at I don't know if any of the people are around anymore, Chris, but if you go back, you will find, the regulators will tell you this, that we had the least litigation by multiples of any institution. Everybody was always astonished, how could we have so little litigation? And the answer is simple, and I know you guys are lawyers, but we wouldn't turn over to the lawyers. What we would do is say, what is the business issue here? Are we in the right or in the wrong? If we're in the right, does the other guy, even though he may not be entirely right, does he have some kind of equity? And should we have treated him differently on an equity basis, even if we're right legally? And we would resolve the problem in their favor. You find that you don't have litigation when you do that.
Right, right. Just so you know, Al's not a lawyer. He's actually on detail here from the FDIC. So he's also knowledgeable.
I'm sorry, Al. I apologize.
Is it okay?
I sadly am a lawyer. so let me tell us generally, you know, what else you were seeing that were problems, you know, that contributed to this crisis, other than as you've already talked to us about, you know, the
now, I'm not an expert on the crisis. I've never seen so many self-made, self-announced pundits and savants. But I have seen some good work done on the letter we wrote to Lou Briskman of 60 Minutes. I have a lot of attachments of various articles. And I remember one in particular I don't have in front of me was written by a guy named John Cassidy, who's a very, very wise person. And I think some of those guys got to the heart of the problem. Obviously, the number of the tremendous leverage, the number of garbage loans were made. The one thing I made a big mistake about is I never thought that the actions of these mortgage bankers and people who were doing the kinds of lending they did, which I described as toxic, would roll over to the good lenders and would impact everybody. Remember I talked about simulations?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we ran simulations as high as a 20% decline in home prices, which I thought was off the page. but to have a decline of 40, 50, 60%, that just never entered my mind. So it shows that in an environment in which a lot of crazy things are going on with derivatives, which I don't fully understand, and these CDOs and this terrible lending, who thought it would affect good lenders? I did not. I was very early in attacking the New Centuries of the world and the Ameriquests of the world, and that's really in large part why in our private life we funded and helped create and fund the Center for Responsible Lending. Because if you looked at New Century and Ameriquest, no matter what they say, it was totally clear to me that they had figured a way out to strip equity from low and moderate income people. And that just drove me crazy. And that's how they made their money. They stripped the equity from poor people. Are you familiar with the single premium mortgage insurance?
I am, but I would like you to explain it so we have it for the record.
Well, the person who's most knowledgeable is the person who brought that to a halt, and that's Martin Eakes, the person who's the head of Center for Responsible Lending.
Right.
Essentially, there's a legitimate product known as mortgage cancellation insurance in which somebody can pay you an insurance premium every year, and if they die, let's take death, and if they die, the mortgage gets paid off, the guarantee be paid off.
Okay.
It's a good product. As a company, we did it with a third party, and you pay a premium every year that you want to keep it up. What these guys did is they charged, and this is so horrible, these people are functionally financial, the borrowers who they're focused on are what I would call functionally financially illiterate. And they didn't understand what they were signing, what they were getting into. So in addition to paying between 3 and 8 points to a mortgage broker and some additional points to the lender also required mortgage cancellation insurance, and they paid a 30-year premium up front.
Oh.
Now, it's worse. You said, now I'm going to give you the double lock, okay? That's bad, but it's much worse than that. So this is really the subprime loan. This is a 228. So what then happens is, if you think about it, there's a mortgage broker involved in this and the lender, and they both know that at the end of 2 years, the rate is going to jump to a rate which is impossible for that borrower to pay.
Uh-huh.
It's endemic in the loan. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And this is in the writings of the CRL, incidentally. And what they do is they contact the borrower, and if it's the mortgage broker that does it, let's take the worst case, and the mortgage broker gets there before the lender, and he talks the guy into refinancing the loan. Remember, they figured out how much equity he still has left, because there's no equity, they won't touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Right.
So what they then do is the mortgage broker is going to charge fees again between 3 and 8%, and the lender's going to charge some fees for the refinance, and then the lender's going to charge him a new single premium credit policy for 30 years.
All supposedly legal because it's disclosed in the contract, right?
Is that not horrible?
Yes.
They'll do it as long as there's equity in the property.
Right.
So this is what, this is actually in large part what contributed to our decision to create and fund CRL.
Mm-hmm.
Because I couldn't stand it. And that guy, incidentally, if you want to know, ended up Ron Arnell as an ambassador.
Yes, originally of Long Beach Savings and then Ameriquest and... then the ambassador, and then I think he died a year or two ago, right?
That's right. You did. You got it exactly right. So that's my real horror story.
Mm-hmm. No, I remember
Mr. Arnall, actually, before even AmeriQuest got started. I think there was way back in the day, I was down at Long Beach for a couple of weeks just looking at something. I think that was before.
That was a big mistake WAMU made, getting involved with Long Beach, because that made them hungry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right, that was a big part of their
stuff. What people miss is, because it's hard to believe, is how technology can facilitate ripping people off. So, do you remember Providian, which is not a lender, but you know the credit card company?
I do.
And Providian, ultimately, you know, they ultimately took them down. But I'll just give you a quick story, which will show the sophistication. I'm gonna not go over the fact that when they solicit you and they say, why are you paying $21.95? Why are you paying $22.50? We'll give you 6 months at 3%, and after that the rate will be 21. And then when you find out later that you paid a transaction fee, and when you make the calculation, you find out that the interest rate that they're suckering you into is already higher than the rate that you're now paying.
Right.
So that's the beginning of it. Then you can't find the amount due. Literally can't find it on there. And thirdly, the best story of all is they send you an envelope to send your payment in. And if you live in San Francisco, it's sent to the Waltham, Massachusetts Service Center. And if you live in Massachusetts, they send it to the San Francisco Service Center.
Right.
That means you lose 1 to 3 days. That means that you, if you, like most people, you pay towards the end, the chances are, because of mail service, that you will have a loan that was made, a payment made on time that is paid late. Most people didn't pick that up. Almost nobody picked it up. We found it by accident.
Mm-hmm.
And we let the controller know about it.
Amazing.
So, I mean, they have to understand there are people like that in this world.
No, I know that from my.
And you saw the ProPublica CDO story,
mm-hmm.
in which those guys. And incidentally, you know, Countrywide used to buy the garbage that, you know, if you look at those deals that were made, those structured deals, it's like an inverted pyramid. You got the AAAs, the senior AAA, AAA, AA, BB, X, and so forth, and the crap. Supporting it all is at the bottom, right? The one
right.
Taking the risk. So Countrywide, you know, had a system where they bought some of that stuff, a fair amount of that stuff themselves, which supported the deals. And it was, what I didn't know is the stuff that ProPublica published, which is there were this enormous amount of stuff that was done with this phony buying. It wasn't real buying. They just created loans and kept the problem going much longer than it had to, and destroyed more homes and more people's lives.
You mean just CDOs buying CDOs?
Right.
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 Right. Yeah, we've been looking at that also.
And the Magnetar is fascinating, because what that guy figured out is if you have a package of $1 billion, it may be supported ultimately by a 10 million piece of crap. So what you do is you buy the 10 million piece of crap, which you know you're going to take a loss on, but you short the $1 billion package on which you're going to make a fortune.
Right. I mean, we've seen. I mean, I have read the article and we've been looking at that. And yeah, if you're taking a long position on a very small number, that by the way is going to pay you some premium income in the.
You know, you should feel free to talk to those guys. They're very, very smart guys.
Yeah. We actually have.
Jesse Eichinger and Jake Bernstein.
Yeah, we've talked to him. I talked to him a couple times. I haven't talked to him since the recent article came out, but I talked to him when the first one came out. So yeah, they were very helpful.
Mr. Sandler, let me ask you something. After you sold Golden West, did you have any role in Wachovia, either at the bank level or at the holding company level?
No, the only thing there was is, as you may or may not know, unlike most transactions where there's a merger, we did not take any money. These four senior people, we made a condition of transaction because they expected the previous deal, the guy got $150 to $200 million. told them we didn't want any money. We just wanted a larger severance package for our employees. He did put me on as a consultant, marrying me as a consultant. Again, he had, I'll give you all the detail, he had offered us the same salary we were then making. We turned that down. We agreed to take a much smaller amount of money, but told him again that we didn't know how we would provide value. We were going into our new life, which we had been doing philanthropy for many years, but we wanted to do it full time. And we made a number of suggestions, and I don't think they were much interested in our point of view.
How long were you a consultant for? And when you talk about him, do you mean Mr. Thompson?
Yeah, Ken Thompson. Yeah. Very nice man, but I don't think he was much interested in, you know, he was his company was big, my company was small. I don't think he had much interest in what we had to say.
And how long were you a consultant for there?
Well, I ran the payroll for 07 and 08, I guess, until the transaction was over. But by that, I mean I was on a payroll only. I was not I was not utilized.
Understanding you were not being utilized, you know, one of the things we did see when we looked at Wachovia, and we've touched on this a little since you mentioned that half the losses that Wells has been reporting are from loans originated after Wachovia purchased Golden West. But did you, were you?
I had nothing to do with the lending.
But were you?
I didn't have any. The kind of thing is, I can remember what I talked to him about. I critiqued their management structure. I critiqued their investor relations because I had access to no information at all. I got no information.
Okay, so you weren't. And what I was going to ask you was, were you able to monitor the performance of the payment option ARM book?
You know, I'm interested, but I listened to all the earnings conferences, but I had no input or activity at all.
And when you may recall that it was either the last quarter of 07, but certainly when they got into the, and certainly the second quarter of 08 when they announced, I think, close to a $9 billion loss, were you having any discussions with them then, since, you know, they were at least reporting then, and they were, in fact, booking, you know, fairly
they
large?
They were taking reserves of losses which are never going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, and this is in the public record, you know, some of the stories refer to Golden West caused the demise of Wachovia. But here's something you haven't heard from anybody or seen. If you look at the seven quarters before they were acquired by Wells, so they reported information, actual losses, not talking about reserves for either company, just actual losses booked, mm-hmm. were from Golden West during that period was $1.6 billion. The losses for Wachovia, not talking about reserves for their other losses, which were monumental, were $15
billion. So
I don't know if you've looked at Wachovia World
that?
Part of it, but I'll bet you didn't know that if you did.
I didn't, but is that the same thing as charge-offs?
Yeah, those are charge-offs hits. So, for example, they had a lot of charge-offs. They had a telemarketing scandal. They had an auction rate scandal. They had a silo scandal. So let's see. They had $8 billion in market disruption losses. That's CDOs, structured investments, trading losses, leverage finance. They had $3 billion in other net charge-offs. They had billions in losses from auction rate security settlements. Silos, you know, sale-in, lease-out, leasing transactions. BOLI, bank-owned life insurance, which was a really big scandal because they took all the proceeds from that and put it in a Citicorp high-risk portfolio, which I think ended up at zero or close to it. They took hedge fund investment losses. They paid about $150 million to settle a telemarketing scam. There was a federal criminal investigation into alleged drug money laundering that ultimately settled with the Justice Department for $160 million.
Right.
All this is public record. But what you know is that they took a lot of reserves on the option arm. Isn't that strange that what you and others know, remember from all of this, which was what was primarily discussed at their earnings conferences, were reserves taken for losses on Golden West, and you know virtually nothing, and that virtually nothing about $15 billion in losses and the types of losses they were. That's strange, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Now, I will tell you, we did know about those other losses because they had to report them.
So right. Did you know it was $15
billion
no, versus off 1.6? And now we know that they took reserves for losses that ain't happening.
Well, right. I mean, that's your point is well taken, is that even with those other losses, certainly what was being reported as driving the losses were the provisions as opposed to the charge-offs and the other hits.
That's what they spent all their time talking about.
Right.
And there are a number of reasons. Obviously, everybody was questioning what about option arms. They didn't realize that what the option arm that they were worried about, they didn't know there was a difference between Countrywide, WAMU, and IndyMac, and Golden West. They didn't know there was a difference between those three, and which were sellers of loans without any risk attendant, as so they thought. And in Sally, you'll notice in the letter, I have to confess to you in preparation for this meeting, there's a portion on our myths section in which we cite, or someplace in which we cite these various letters, and I was looking at the excerpts, and this stuff was written in 2003, 2005, and 2006. We may not have been smart enough to short the real estate market, and I may not have been smart enough to do a lot of other things, but we sure called the problems. They've all happened as we were complaining about them in those letters. It's kind of fascinating to look at those letters again and see how many of those things, in fact, happened.
And
I just read that yesterday in preparation for this meeting.
And are all the letters you're talking about on your website?
Yes, they are.
Okay. Because I will tell you that one of the things that we do want to look at, and I hope include in the report that we finish at the end of the year, information on folks that, you know, were raising the red flags and were, you know, saying, hey, you know, the emperor has no clothes.
My history, our company's history, has always been one of great interest in public policy. You'll actually see on there something really weird, and it'll be most only interesting to you, Chris, and that because it goes back to a time when you were around. And that was in the 80s, when there was all this pressure to reduce capital requirements, we took out a full-page ad in the Washington Post begging Congress not to lower capital requirements but to strengthen them, which made us, you know, a bête noir in our own industry. I mean, everybody hated our guts because we were calling for increased capital, similar to what we've done in the recent years, where we argued semi-hysterically against Basel II, which was going to reduce capital requirements. It's interesting, in rereading the letters, it looks like Basel III, with all of its, still has some weaknesses in it, have adopted virtually everything we recommended. And we, during that, here's an interesting story for you about color. When we opposed Basel II and made a lot of noise, as we typically do, again, we were persona non grata because the Fed really wanted Basel II to be adopted for reasons we could never fully figure out. And there was enormous pressure for financial institutions not to oppose Basel II. So we were the only financial institution that had the guts to tell the Fed they were all wet. And the only other person who did, and I don't know if you come across him, was Bill Isaac, who used to be head of FDIC.
Right.
And we used to compare our letters to see who was more aggressive and more unpleasant. He wrote a lot of stuff on Basel II in the American Banker that were right on the money.
Mr. Sandler, can you recall in Golden West business activity if you offered payment option arms for non-owner-occupied properties and so sort of like investor.
Yeah, but
properties.
We didn't do that much in non-owner. I don't like non-owner. We did X percentage because it's going to happen,
right.
And we had tougher requirements for that. But we would. That was our loan of choice was the option arm. Some people it was inappropriate for, and some people would not take it. For those people, we would give them a fixed and sell it.
Okay.
Mr. Sandler, I don't think we have any other questions. Anything else you want to tell us?
No, you let me vent more than most people permit me to.
We very much appreciate your time. I will tell you what I tell everybody. You know, Al and I will talk, take a look at our notes. If we figured out we forgot to ask you something.
Hey, feel free. I'm around. I'm traveling in the next 2 weeks, but my office can reach me at any time. And I do recommend you do it with your colleagues. You know, there's a lot of it. It's hard to go through the site, and maybe it's in terms of all the pressures on you, it may not be worth it. But there's an enormous amount of material in there. We were very careful to do something which is hard to do. There's nothing in there which, in fact, is not supported by the public record. In other words, it's not like, gee, he said this, can I trust him?
Right.
What's in there can be validated.
Okay.
We left out anything that couldn't be validated.
Well, we'll definitely take another look at the information. I know Al's taken a look at a lot of it, if not all of it.
I think you ought to look at one of the things, if you're going to look at our letters that we wrote to CBS and the Times, some of that may not be of interest to you, but on the letter to CBS, the attachments, we were cutting out articles at a time that spoke to the larger issues you're speaking to, and you might want to look at that.
Great.
But I suspect you've read most of it anyway.
Yes. Okay, well, Mr. Sandler, thank you again very much for your time. It was a pleasure talking to you.
At all. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.